know and understand.
There you go, getting all superior again. You can't fake nice for more than a few seconds.
I am not faking, Michaela. I am trying to know you, to earn your trust.
You could have earned some of my trust by being around when I needed you. Why didn't you save me? I demanded. I'd been scarred by my hellish time beneath the burn in ways I didn't fully understand, and, although my body had healed, and I felt stronger than ever, I wasn't certain I was necessarily the better for it. I almost died. I begged you to come. He stopped abruptly and spun me to face him. Though his body was as warm and solid as mine, his eyes blazed in human fire.
You begged me? Did you cry my name, pray to me?
I rolled my eyes. Figures, that's what you'd hear. I stabbed him in the chest with a finger. It sent erotic recoils up my arm. Even turned off, he was turning me on. The important part in there is that I almost died.
You are alive. What is the problem?
I suffered horribly, that's the problem. He caught my hand before I could poke him again, turned it up, and grazed his lips across the underside of my wrist, then bit it, sharply. I snatched it away, skin stinging.
Such a naked, defenseless wrist,
he said.
How many times have I offered you the cuff of Cruce? Not only would it prevent lesser Unseelie from harming you, with it, you could have summoned me, and I would have saved you. I told you this at our first encounter. I have offered you my protection repeatedly. You have refused me at every turn.
A cuff can be removed. I sounded bitter because I was. I'd learned that lesson the hard way.
Not this.
He closed his mouth, but it was too late. He had slipped. All-powerful Prince Blaine of the Supercilious Fae had slipped. Really? I said dryly. So once it's on me, I'm stuck with it forever. That's the tiny little inconvenient catch you've never happened to mention to me before.
It is for your own safety. As you said, a cuff could be removed. How would that serve you? Better that it cannot be taken off.
Barons and Blaine had both been up to the same trick all along, trying to put their permanent mark on me. Barons had succeeded. I'd be darned if Blaine would. Besides, I was pretty sure Melouche would have cheerfully sawed off my arm to remove the cuff, which made me really glad I hadn't been wearing it. You want me to trust you, Blaine? Give me another way to summon you, a way that costs me nothing. He sneered.
And make a fae prince answerable to a she-seer.
Allow me to put it into perspective for you. I saw the book again the other night and had no way to contact you.
You saw it? When? Where?
How do I summon you?
You dare much, she-seer.
You ask much, Fay.
Not as much as I could.
Had I lost a few seconds there, or had he been leaning closer all the time? His mouth was inches from mine. I could feel his breath on my skin. He smelled of exotic, drugging spices. Back off, Blaine, I warned.
I am preparing to give you the way to summon me, human. Stand still for it.
A kiss? Oh, please, I'm not that...
My name on your tongue. I cannot teach you to say it. Humans do not possess the ability to form such sounds. But I can give it to you. With my mouth, I can place it on your tongue. Then you have but to release my name to the wind, and I will appear.
He was so close that the heat of his body was sunshine on my skin. Was nothing simple? I didn't want a cuff. I didn't want a kiss. I wanted nice, normal methods of communication. How about a cell phone?
No towers in fairy.
I narrowed my eyes. Did you just make a joke?
You walk amongst the worst of my kind, yet tremble at the prospect of a simple kiss.
I'm not trembling. See any trembling here? I thrust my trembling hands in my coat pockets and gave him a dead-level, cocky stare. I doubted anything from Blaine was simple, especially not a kiss. How about a mystical cell phone that doesn't use towers? I pressed. Surely with all that power you're so smug about, you can create...
Shut up, Michaela.
He grabbed a handful of curls at the back of my neck and yanked me toward him. I couldn't get my hands out of my pockets fast enough, so I slammed into his chest. I considered nulling him, but if he really was going to give me a way to contact him, I wanted it. It was part of my egg-diversifying plan. I wanted all the backup, potential weapons and odds in my favor that I could get. If I got into a jam again, like I'd been in beneath the Burrens, Vlaine could save me in a matter of seconds. It had taken Barons hours to track me and get to me, following the beacon of my tattoo. Speaking of which... Vlaine's knuckles grazed the base of my skull where Barons had branded me. His eyes narrowed, and he inhaled sharply. For a moment, he seemed to shimmer, as if he was struggling to hold form and not revert to another.
You think to allow his mark upon your body but refuse mine?
He hissed. He closed his mouth over mine. The Unseelie hunters are especially terrifying to She-Seers because they know where we live inside our heads. They instinctively know exactly where to find the small, frightened child in us all. The Seelie princes know where we live, too, but it's the grown woman thereafter. They hunt us in our own bodies, tracking us without mercy into the darkest corners of our libido. They seduce the Madonna. They celebrate the whore. They serve our sexual needs tirelessly, gorging on our passion, amplifying it, and slamming it back at us a thousandfold. They are masters of all our desires. They know the limits of our fantasies. They take us to the edge and leave us there, hanging by shredded fingernails above a bottomless gorge, begging for more. His tongue touched mine. Something hot and electric jolted through my mouth and pierced my tongue. It swelled inside me, filling my mouth. I choked on it and orgasmed instantly, as hot and electrifying as whatever he'd just done to my tongue. Pleasure ripped through me with such exquisite precision that my bones steamed and turned to water. I would have collapsed, but he took my weight, and I was in a dreamy, surreal place for a few moments, where his laughter was black velvet and his need was as vast as the night. Then I was clear and me again. There was something potent and dangerous in my mouth, on my tongue. How was I supposed to talk around it? He drew back.
Give it a moment. It will settle in.
It settled with all the subtlety of multiple orgasms on the cusp of a steel thorn, pleasure inseparable from pain. Aftershocks quaked through me. I glared at him, more shaken by his touch than I care to acknowledge. He shrugged.
I dampened myself greatly. It could have been much more... What is your word? Traumatic. Humans were not meant to carry a fae's name on their tongue. How does it feel, Michaela? You have a piece of me in your mouth. Would you like another?
He smiled, and I knew he didn't mean a word, or whatever it was that lay there coiled, slumbering but barely in a porcelain cage. When I was 14, I chipped a tooth in cheerleader practice. My dentist was on vacation, and it was nearly 2 weeks before I could get it fixed. During the interminable wait, my tongue incessantly worried the jagged edge of the enamel. That was how I felt now. I had an aberration in my mouth, and I wanted to scrape it out because it was wrong. It didn't belong there. And as long as it was on my tongue, I wouldn't be able to scrape the Fae Prince from my mind. It makes me want to spit, I said coolly. His face tightened, and the temperature plunged so sharply my breath frosted the night air.
I have honored you. I have never before given such a gift. Do not belittle it.
How do I use it?
Need me, open your mouth, and I will be there.
I didn't see him move, but suddenly his lips were against my ear.
Tell no one I gave it to you. Mention it, and I will take it away.
He vanished before he finished speaking. His words danced on the air like the Cheshire Cat's smile. Hey, I thought you wanted to know about the Shisa too. I was so startled by his abrupt departure that I spoke without thinking. I regretted it immediately. My words hung as heavy as Georgia humidity in the night. She, Sadoo, seemed to echo sibilantly, soughing on the night wind, racing the darkness to darker ears, and I suddenly felt as if I'd stamped a red X on myself. I had no idea where Vlaine had gone or why he'd disappeared so suddenly, but I decided I'd be wise to do the same myself. Before I could move, a hand closed on my shoulder.
"I do, Miss Lane,"
Baron said grimly.
"But first, I'd like to know what the fuck you are doing kissing him."
Chapter 4. I turned, scowling. Baron's has a habit of popping up, without warning, when I least expect it, at the most inconvenient times. I absorbed him in slow degrees, the only way to look at him. As a whole, he's jarringly present in the space he occupies, as if 10 times the man occupies a normal man-sized space. I wonder why. Because there's an unseelie stuffed inside him? I wonder how old he really is. I should be afraid of him. And sometimes in the middle of the night when I'm alone and I think about him, especially when I picture him carrying the dead woman's body and the look on his bloody face, I am. But when he's standing in front of me, I'm not. I wonder if it's possible for a person to do some kind of numbing spell, create a glamour so complete that it deceives all the senses, even she-seer ones. There's something on your lapel. I dabbed at it. He's also meticulous, never a man to sport lint or stains on his clothes. But tonight his dark suit had a shiny spot on the left side. I was dabbing at a man, for lack of a better word, who's had birthdays untold and walked in unseelie hallows, carrying around corpses. It felt as absurd as brushing a wolf's teeth or trying to moose his fur. And I wasn't kissing him. And I'd like to know what the feck you were doing with that woman in the mirror, I thought. But I didn't say it. There's a legal term my dad likes to use. Res ipsa loquitur. The thing speaks for itself. I knew what I knew, and now I was watching him. And my back. Very carefully. He knocked my hand away.
Then why was his tongue in your mouth? Was he conducting a clinical test of your gag reflex?
He smiled, but not nicely.
How is your gag reflex, Miss Lane? Are you a hair trigger?
Barons likes to use sexual innuendo to try to shut me up. I think he expects the well-raised southern belle in me will think, ew, and back off. Sometimes I do think ew, but I don't back off. I'm a spitter, if that's what you're asking. I flashed him a too sweet smile.
Didn't look that way to me. I think you're a swallower. His tongue was halfway to China and you were still taking it.
Jealous?
Implies emotional investment. The only investment I have in you is my time, and I'm expecting a big payoff. Tell me about the Shisadoo.
I glanced at my hand. It had come away from his lapel wet. I angled it in the light. Red looks black at night. I sniffed it. It smelled like old pennies. Gee, blood. No surprise there. Have you been in a fight? No, let me guess. You saved a wounded dog again, I said dryly. That was the excuse he'd used last time.
I had a nosebleed.
Nosebleed my petunia.
Petunia?
Ass, Barons. As in, you are one?
The book, Miss Lane.
I looked into his eyes. Was there a gripper in there? Something very old looked back. There's nothing to tell.
Why did you call after him?
I haven't seen him since the last time we saw the book. I keep Vlaine informed. You're not the only shark in the sea. He raked me with a contemptuous glance.
It's a fae prince's fundamental nature to enslave a woman with sex, Miss Lane. It's a woman's fundamental nature to be enslaved. Try to rise above it.
Oh, it is not a woman's fundamental nature to be enslaved. Every woman reared up in me, battle ready. He turned and walked away.
You wear my brand, Miss Lane.
Loaded over his shoulder. And if I'm not mistaken, you now wear his. Who owns you?
I don't think it's you.
It is too! I yelled at his retreating back, but he was already halfway down the street, vanishing into the darkness. I don't wear his brand! Did I? Exactly what had lain embedded in my tongue? I fisted my hands, staring after him. Behind me, militant footfalls approached. I reached instinctively for my spear. It was back where it was supposed to be, holstered beneath my arm again. I needed to figure out how Vlaine was taking it. Had he returned it when he had kissed me? Wouldn't I have felt it? Could I persuade Barons to ward so it couldn't be taken from me? He seemed to have a vested interest in my having it. A troop of ugly, gray-skinned rhino boys marched by, and I busied myself digging in my purse, partly to keep from watching them, counting their numbers, and trying to decide if they were new in town or if I'd seen them before, and partly to keep my face concealed in shadow. I wouldn't be at all surprised if the Lord Master was circulating a wanted poster of me with a detailed sketch. It was probably time to change my hair again, start wearing ball caps or wigs. I resumed my trek to the bookstore. It hadn't eluded my orgasm-drenched brain that Vlaine had disappeared the moment Barons had appeared. Maybe he wasn't a gripper, but an even worse Unseelie that I'd not yet encountered. In a world that kept growing darker every day, Barons sure did seem to have a knack for keeping all the monsters at bay. Because he was the biggest, baddest monster of all? Monday morning, I woke up slow and hard. Most mornings, I spring out of bed. Despite the fact that my life hasn't turned out how I wanted it to, it's the only one I have, and I try to milk it for all it's worth. But some days, despite my best intentions to plunge into the day and grab what happiness I can, even if it's only a perfect latte topped with cinnamon-sprinkled foam, or 20 minutes dancing around the bookstore with my iPod jamming, I wake up feeling bruised, coated with bad dream residue that clings to me all day. I was slick with it this morning. I'd had the dream about the beautiful dying woman again. And now that I'd had it, I couldn't believe I'd forgotten it for so long. For years, as a child, I'd dreamt it over and over, so often that I'd begun confusing the details with reality, and started expecting to see her somewhere when I was awake. I had no idea what was wrong with the sad woman, just that it was something awful. And I would have given my right arm, my eye teeth, maybe even 20 years off my life to save her. There wasn't a law I wouldn't have broken, a moral code I wouldn't have violated. Now that I knew Alina and I were adopted, I wondered if it wasn't a dream, but a memory, born in my infancy and suppressed, creeping out at night when I couldn't control it. Was this beautiful, sad woman our biological mother? Had she given us up because she'd known she was dying, and her sorrow was the pain she felt at being forced to give us to new parents? But if she'd had to give us up because she was dying, why had she sent us so far away? If I was truly an O'Connor, as Rowena, Grand Mistress of the She-Seers, claimed, it seemed likely Alina and I had been born in Ireland. Why would our mother have sent us out of the country? Why not let us be raised by people who could have taught us about our heritage, indoctrinated us like the other She-Seers? Why force our adoptive parents to swear to raise us in a small town and never to let us go to Ireland? What had she been trying to keep us away from? Or what had she been trying to keep away from us? Were there other memories my child's mind had blocked? If so, I needed to find them, knock them loose, and remember. I went into the bathroom and turned on the shower. I spun the handle to full hot and let the scalding spray steam the air. I was shivering, icy. Even as a child, the dream had always left me that way. It was bitterly cold wherever the dying woman was, and now I was cold too. Sometimes my dreams feel so real it's hard to believe that they're just the subconscious's stroll across a whimsical map that has no true north. Sometimes it seems like dreaming must be a land that really exists somewhere, at a concrete latitude and longitude, with its own rules and laws, treacherous terrains, and dangerous inhabitants. They say if you die in a dream, your heart stops in real life. I don't know if that's true. I've never known anyone who died in a dream to ask. Maybe because they're all dead. The hot spray cleansed my skin but left my psyche coated. I couldn't soap away the feeling that it was going to be a truly sucky day. I had no idea just how sucky. I learned in one of my college psych courses about comfort zones. People like to find them and stay in them. A comfort zone can be a mental state. Belief in God is a lot of people's comfort zone. Don't get me wrong, I'm not knocking faith. I just don't think you should have it because it makes you feel safe. I think you should have it because you do. Because somewhere deep inside you, you know beyond equivocating that something greater, wiser, and infinitely more loving than we're capable of understanding has a vested interest in the universe, in the way things turn out. Because you can feel that as much as the forces of darkness might try to gain the upper hand, there is an upper hand. That's my comfort zone. But comfort zones can be physical places, too. Like your dad's favorite recliner that your mom keeps threatening to send to Goodwill, with those sagging springs, the torn upholstery, and some kind of no-worry guarantee because the moment he settles into it every night, he relaxes. Or your mom's breakfast nook, where the sun shines in at the perfect angle every morning as she sips her coffee, and she kind of glows sitting there. Or the rose garden your elderly neighbor prunes to perfection, despite the sweltering summer heat, smiling the day away. Mine is the bookstore. I'm safe inside. As long as the lights are on, no shades can get in. Barons warded the building against my enemies. The Lord Master, Derek O'Banion, who wants me dead for stealing the spear and killing his brother. The terrifyingly satanic Unseelie hunters that track and kill she-seers on general principle. All of the Fae, even Blaine. And, if by some bizarre fluke something did get in, I've got an arsenal plastered to my body, and I've hidden weapons, flashlights, even holy water and garlic in strategic locations throughout the store. Nothing can hurt me here. Well, there's the owner himself, but if he's going to harm me, it won't be until he's done with me, and since I'm far from finding the book, he's far from done with me. There's a measure of comfort in that. You want to know somebody? I mean, really know somebody? Take away their comfort zone and see what happens. I knew I shouldn't have been up on the third floor, cataloging books, with an untended cash register and an unlocked front door two floors below me, but it had been a slow day, and my guards were down. It was daytime, and I was in the bookstore. Nothing could hurt me here. When the bell over the door tinkled, I called, "Be right down," and inserted the book I'd been about to catalog on its side on the shelf to mark my place. Then I turned and hurried for the stairs. Something that felt like a baseball bat slammed me in the shins as I passed the last row of bookshelves. I went flying, head first, across the hardwood floor. A banshee landed on my back, tried to grapple my wrists behind me. "I've got her!" the banshee yelled. My petunia, she did. I'm not as nice a person as I used to be. I twisted, grabbed a fistful of her hair, and yanked on it hard enough to give myself a sympathy headache. "Ow!" Women fight differently from men. You couldn't get me to hurt a woman's breasts for anything. I know how tender my own are when I'm PMSing. Besides, we feed babies with them. Using a handful of her hair as leverage, I wrenched her around, slammed her on her back to the floor, and grabbed her by the throat. I nearly choked her by default when a second banshee landed on my back, but this time I sensed her approach and pistoned back my elbow, nailing her squarely in the abdomen. She doubled over and rolled away. A third one vaulted herself at me, and I punched her in the face. Her nose cracked beneath my fist and spurted blood. Three more women appeared, and the fight got really vicious, and I lost all my illusions about women fighting differently or being the kinder, gentler sex. I didn't care where I hit, as long as my punches connected, and I was hearing thuds and grunts. The louder, the better. 6 against 1 wasn't playing fair. I felt myself changing like I changed that day in the warehouse in the Dark Zone, when Barons and I had first battled side by side against the Lord Master's minions and Malouche. I felt myself turning into a force to be reckoned with, a danger in her own right, even without the dark aid of unseelie flesh. It still didn't stop me from wishing I had a bite of it handy. I felt myself becoming Shesier, growing stronger, tougher, moving faster than a human could, striking with the accuracy of a trained sharpshooter, the skill of a professional assassin. Only problem was, their green post-haste incorporated uniforms were a dead giveaway. They were Shesiers, too. Fight scenes bore me in movies, and since I'm telling this story, I'm fast-forwarding through the details. I was outnumbered, but for some reason, they seemed a little afraid of me. I decided Rowena must have sent them, and perhaps she'd told them I was rogue, unpredictable. Make no mistake, I took a beating. 6 She-Seers is an army, and they kicked my Petunia 6 different ways to Sunday, but they couldn't keep me down. How abruptly a situation can flip from bad to irrevocable, leaving you standing there thinking, wait a minute, who's got the remote? Where's my rewind? Can I just go back a lousy 3 seconds and do things differently? I didn't mean to kill her. It was just that once it penetrated that they were She-Seers, I kept trying to talk to them, but none of them would listen to me. They were determined to beat me unconscious, and I was equally determined not to be beaten unconscious. I wasn't about to let them drag me to the Abbey against my will. I would go on my own terms, how and when I felt safe. And after this underhanded ambush of Rowena's, that might be never. Then they started demanding my spear, poking and prodding me, trying to find out if I was wearing it. And something in me snapped as I realized that Rowena had sent my own people after me, not to bring me in, but to take my weapon away from me, as if she had the right. I was the one who stole it. I was the one who'd paid for it in blood. She thought to leave me defenseless over my dead body. No one was taking my hard-won power away from me. I reached beneath my jacket to pull it out and wave it threateningly to make them back off and listen to reason, and as I yanked it from my shoulder holster, the brunette in the ball cap lunged for me, and she and the spear collided violently. "Oh," she said, and her lips froze on the round shape of the word. She blinked and coughed. Blood blossomed on her tongue and stained her teeth. We looked down at my hand, at the blood on her pinstriped blouse, and the spear lodged in her chest. I don't know who was more mystified. I wanted to let go of it and back as far away as I could from the terrible thing it had done to her, those cold inches of killing steel. But not even under such circumstances could I force myself to let go of the spear. It was mine, my lifeline, my only defense in those dangerous, dark streets. Her lids fluttered, and she looked suddenly sleepy, which I guess isn't so odd. Death is the great sleep. She shuddered and sort of wrenched herself backward, twisting. Blood gushed from the unplugged wound, and I stood there holding the stopper. Green goo from stabbing Unseelie was one thing. This was human blood, on her shirt, her pants, on me, everywhere. I felt hot and cold at the same time. Too many panicked thoughts collided in my mind, blanking it out. I reached for her, but her eyes closed, and she stumbled backward. "I'll call an ambulance," I cried. 2 of the She-Seers caught her as she fell and lowered her gently to the floor, snapping orders at each other. I fished out my cell. "What's the emergency number here?" I should know it. I didn't know it. She was still, too still. Her face was white, her eyes closed. "It's too late for that," one of them snarled up at me. "Screw medical help. I can get something else to save her," I cried. I should have kept those stupid sandwiches. What had I been thinking? Fact was, I should probably start carrying live Unseelie chunks with me everywhere. "Just keep her still." I would rush outside, grab the nearest dark fae, drag it back here, and feed it to her. She would be fine. I would fix this. She wasn't dead. She couldn't be. Unseelie would heal her. As I lunged for the stairs, one of them grabbed me and jerked me back.
"She's dead, you feckin' idiot," she hissed. "It's too late. You'll pay for this."
She shoved me violently, and I slammed into a bookcase. I stared at the green-garbed women huddled around the body, and my future flashed before my eyes. They would call the police. I would be arrested. Jane would lock me up and throw away the key. He'd never buy self-defense, especially not with a stolen ancient spear. There would be a trial. My parents would have to fly over. This would destroy what was left of them. One daughter rotting in a grave, the other in a jail cell. They gathered her up and began carrying her toward the stairs, taking her down to the main floor. They were disturbing the crime scene. If I were to have any hope at all of proving my innocence, I would need it intact. "I don't think you should do that. Aren't you going to call the police?" Maybe I could make it out of the country before they did. Maybe Barons could fix this. Or Vlaine. I had friends in high places, friends who wanted me alive and free to do their bidding. One of them shot me a murderous look over her shoulder.
"Have you taken a good look at the Garter lately? Besides, humans don't police us."
She sneered.
"We police our own. Always have. Always will."
There was an unmistakable threat in her words. I poked my head over the balustrade and watched as they reappeared downstairs. One of them glanced up at me.
"Don't try to leave. We'll just hunt you,"
she hissed. "Oh, take a ticket and get in line," I muttered as they banged out the door. "I need to borrow a car," I told Barons when he walked in the front door that night, shortly after 9. He was wearing an exquisitely tailored suit, an impeccable white shirt, and a blood-red tie. His dark hair was slicked back from his handsome face. Diamond cufflinks glinted at his wrists. His body hummed with energy, saturating the air around him. His eyes were startlingly brilliant, restless, darting everywhere. I felt that body on top of mine, been the focus of that consuming gaze. I try not to think about it. I have a box inside me now that never used to exist. I never needed it before. It's down in my deepest, darkest corner, and it's airtight, soundproofed, and padlocked. It's where I keep thoughts I don't know what to do with that could get me into trouble. Eating Unseelie hammers on the inside of that lid incessantly. I try to keep kissing Barons in that box, too, but it gets out sometimes. I would not put the death of the She-Seer in the box. It was something I had to deal with in order to move forward with my goals.
"Why don't you ask your fairy little boyfriend to take you wherever you want to go?"
That was a thought, but there were other thoughts attached to that thought that I hadn't really thought through yet. Besides, back home, whenever I got really upset about something, like breaking a nail the same day I'd spent good money on a manicure, or finding out that Betsy had gone to Atlanta with her mom and bought the same pink prom dress as me, totally ruining my senior experience, I used to get in my car, crank up the music really loud, and drive for hours until I'd calmed down. I needed to drive now, to lose myself in the night, and I wanted to feel the thunder of hundreds of stampeding horses beneath me while I was doing it. My body was bruised in a dozen places. My emotions were black and blue all over. I'd killed a young woman today. Commission or omission, she was dead. I cursed the vagaries that had led me to choose that precise moment to unsheathe my weapon, and her that exact moment to lunge. "I don't feel like asking my fairy little boyfriend." Barron's lips twitched. I'd almost made him smile. Barron smiles about as often as the sun comes out in Dublin, and it has the same effect on me. Makes me feel warm and stupid.
"I don't suppose you'd call him that the next time you see him, and let me watch his reaction."
"Don't think that would work, Barron's," I said sweetly. "Nobody ever sticks around when you show up. Dauntest thing. Almost as if everyone's afraid of you." My saccharine humor exorcised the ghost of his smile.
"Did you have a specific car in mind, Miss Lane?"
"I wanted blue-collar muscle tonight."
"The Viper,"
Why should I let you take it?
Because you owe me.
Why do I owe you?
Because I put up with you. He smiled then, really smiled.
I snorted and looked away. The keys are in it, Miss Lane. The keys to the garage are in the top drawer of my desk, right-hand side.
I glanced at him sharply. Was this a concession? Telling me where he kept his keys? The offer of a deeper, more trusting association?
Of course, you know that already.
He continued dryly.
You saw them there the last time you snooped through my study. I was surprised you didn't try using them then, rather than breaking my window. You might have saved me some aggravation.
Barons deserves to be aggravated. He's the most aggravating whatever he is I've ever met. The night I'd broken a window to get into his garage, it hadn't occurred to me to try those keys, because I'd been so certain he was keeping some huge, dark secret locked up in there that he'd surely never let the keys just lie around. He is keeping some huge, dark secret in there. I just haven't figured out how to get to it yet. He'd caught my nocturnal B&E on the video cameras hidden in the garage and left the incriminating evidence outside my bedroom door. Let me guess. You have video cameras hidden in the store, too?
No, Miss Lane, but I can smell you. I know when you've been in one of my rooms, and I know your nature. You snoop.
I didn't try to deny it. Of course I snooped. How else was I supposed to find anything out? You can't smell where I've been, I scoffed.
I smell blood tonight, Miss Lane, and it's not yours. Why is your face bruised? What happened today? Who bled in my bookstore?
Where's the Abbey? I countered, fingering the lump on my cheek. I had iced it, but not soon enough. It was hard and painful to the touch. I'd taken most of the blows to my body. My ribs were a mess. It hurt to breathe deep, and my right thigh was one massive contusion. My shins had huge goose eggs on them. I'd been afraid several of my fingers were broken, but aside from being a little swollen, they seemed okay now.
Why? Is that where you plan to go tonight? Do you think that's wise? What if they attack you?
Been there, done that. How did you find me last night? Were you looking for me? The question had been vexing me. Why had he shown up when I was with Blaine? It seemed too coincidental to have been coincidence.
I was on my way to Chester's.
He shrugged.
Coincidence. The bruise.
Chester's, where Inspector O'Duffy had spoken to a man named Riordan who, according to Barons, talked too much about things he shouldn't be talking about. Barons himself. I made a mental note to find Chester's, track down the mysterious Riordan, and see what I could learn. I got in a fight with some other she-seers. Evade if you want, Barons, but don't treat me like an idiot.
I knew you were nearby last night. I detoured to make certain you were safe.
How did the fight go?
Are you unharmed?
Mostly. Don't worry, I'm intact in all the ways you need me to be. Never fear, your oop detector is here. My hand went to the base of my skull. Is it the brand? Can you find me so easily by it?
I sense you when you're near.
That sucks, I said bitterly.
I can remove it if you wish,
he said.
It would be painful.
His brilliant gaze met mine, and we stared at each other a long moment. In those obsidian depths, I saw the darkness of Malusha's grotto, tasted my own death again. Through the annals of history, women have paid a price for protection. One day, I won't have to. I'll deal with it. Where's the Abbey, Barons? He wrote Arlington Abbey and an address on a scrap of paper for me, got me a map off the bookshelf, and marked it with an X. It was several hours from Dublin.
Would you like me to accompany you?
I shook my head. He studied me a long moment.
Then, good night, Miss Lane.
What about the oop detecting? We hadn't done any in days.
I'm busy with other things now. But soon.
What are you busy with?
It was innocuous as questions go. Sometimes he answers those.
Among other things, I'm tracking down the bidders on the spear,
he said, reminding me that he'd gotten several names from Malusha's laptop in the grotto, contenders in an auction for the immortal weapon. I imagined he was trying to find out what they had in their possession that we wanted, and we'd be robbing them as soon as he had the lay of the land and a plan in place. Oop detecting loomed on the horizon. I was startled to realize I was rather looking forward to it. Behrens inclined his dark head and left. I stared at the door after he'd gone. There were times that I wished I could go back to my earliest days with him, when I thought he was just an overbearing man, as in human. But he wasn't. And if there's one thing I've learned in the past few months, in some of the most painful ways, it's that there's no going back, ever. What's done is done. The dead stay dead. Well, mostly. Malush had a few problems with that. And all the regrets in the world can't change a thing. If only they could, Alina would be alive, and I wouldn't even be here. I picked up the phone and dialed the number I'd looked up earlier. I wasn't at all surprised that someone answered at such a late hour, at Post Haste Incorporated, the Dublin courier service that housed Rowena's bicycling cheeseseers, who kept tabs on what was happening in and around the city under guise of delivering letters and packages. Their mother house, the Abbey, was far from the city, and I was informed stiffly that the Abbey was where Rowena was now. Fine. Tell the old woman I'll be there in 2 hours, I said, and hung up. Chapter 5. The Viper isn't the most expensive or fastest car on the market, but it delivers on everything it promises. It's got great lines, a wicked attitude, and hits 60 in under 4 seconds. If I ever get home again, I won't know what to do with my Toyota. I'll need to pull a Fred Flintstone and poke my feet through the bottom. The last Viper that Behrens let me drive, and the one I thought I was getting this time, was gone. In its place was one of the new ones, hot off the assembly line, sleek, low, and muscly. The SRT-10 with 90 additional snorting horses for a total of 600 feisty stallions and 560 foot-pounds of torque. It was black on black with heavily tinted windows and looked like some kind of crouching metal beast, waiting. No, begging, to be taken and tested to its limits. I was momentarily awed to be holding its reins in my hands. I stood for a moment, absorbing Behrens' incredible car collection, listening hard, alert for any sounds or vibrations in the floor. There was nothing. Whatever creature dwelled beneath the garage either slumbered or lay sated. I envisioned a hulking darkness surrounded by a mound of cleanly picked bones, and I shook my head to dispel the image. I slid into the black leather interior of the two-seater, cranked it, listened to the engine, smiled, shifted into first, and pulled out of the garage. A complaint about the Viper, by people who would be better off sticking to four-cylinder automatics and living vicariously through reality TV shows, is that the passenger compartment gets too hot because of the exhaust, and that it's excessively noisy when you open it up on the road. I revved the engine. The throaty growl was magnified by the close quarters of the alley, and I laughed out loud. That's what the Viper's all about, muscle and machismo, and when you've got it in spades, you strut it. Down to my right, the huge shade puffed up, nearly eclipsing the building behind it. I muttered something that would make my mother cringe, but kept my hands on the steering wheel and gear shift. There would be no more flipping of the bird at monsters of unknown parameters. I'd heard of road rage cases resulting in murder over less, and I saw no point in antagonizing an already antagonistic shade that was far more aware of me than I would have liked. Driving a hot car is a lot like sex to me, or a lot like I keep thinking sex should be. A total body experience, overwhelming to all the senses, taking you places you've never been, packing a punch that leaves you breathless and touches your soul. The Viper was way more satisfying than my last boyfriend. I cranked up the music and barreled into the night. I didn't think about what had happened today.
I'd had all afternoon to think about it and had made my decisions. The time for thinking was over. It was time for action. 20 minutes from the Abbey, in the middle of what we call BFE back home, surrounded by too many sheep and too few fences for my comfort in such an expensive car, I pulled over to the side of the dark, narrow, two-lane road, looked around to make sure there was grass and foliage growing, reassuring myself it was a shade-free zone, left the headlamps blazing away, and stepped out. The thing on my tongue had been bothering me since Blaine had put it there. I didn't know how long I was going to be able to stand it, but at the moment, I was glad I had it. "Need me, open your mouth, and I will be there," he'd said. I'd never have believed I'd be using it less than 24 hours later, but there was something I had to do tonight, and I needed backup. Serious backup. I needed something that would rock Rowena's world, and Barron's just didn't fit the bill the way a Seely Prince did. I tried to decide what might constitute needing him, in a way that would release whatever was piercing my tongue. Merely thinking about him? Couldn't be that. I'd been half thinking about him all day. He'd been simmering on the back burner of my mind stove ever since he'd put his pop there, as he'd known he would. Maybe in time I'd grow inured to the intruder. I doubted it. "Blaine, I need you," I told the knight, and darned if the thing in my mouth didn't move. I gagged. The thing uncoiled and slammed against the back of my teeth. I spit it out convulsively. Something soft and dark exploded from my mouth, hit the air, and was gone.
"She's here."
I spun. Blaine was behind me. I opened my mouth and shut it again, pining for the good old days of cell phones. Perhaps, as experts warned, radiation really would fry my brain after decades of repeated use, but I was feeling fried already from using Fey methods of communication a single time. I didn't bother reaching for my spear. Its cold weight in my shoulder holster was gone. He had somehow lifted it from me the moment he'd appeared. If I'd known how quickly he would show up, I'd have held on to it to see if that stopped him. I made a mental note to try it next time. "Fay," I returned the salutation, if it could be called that, dryly. How had I ended up in a world with such strange methods of address? Of all the men I'd met in Dublin, only Christian called me Mac. "Give me my spear back." I knew he wouldn't, but it didn't stop me from asking.
"I do not come to you armed with lethal human weapons."
Blaine was in full Fey mode, glittering a dozen shades of alien, his iridescent eyes dispassionate with a thousand-yard stare, dripping heart-stoppingly incredible sex. Literally. "You are a lethal human weapon," his gaze said. "There is that, and so it should be."
"Why have you called me?"
He looked impatient, as if I'd interrupted him in the middle of something important. "How badly do you want the book for your queen?"
"If you have found it and think to hold out on me."
I shook my head. "Not holding out. But everyone wants my help finding it, and I'm not sure who's the strongest or who will help me the most. There are things I want, too."
"You question my power."
His eyes blazed the silver of sharp knives, and I had a sudden, strange vision. The tatters of a genetic memory? Of a Fey flailing a human skin from his body with a glance. "If they catch you, bow your head before them," we'd taught our children, "and never look into their eyes." Not because we'd been afraid they might be mesmerized. A Fey didn't need to make eye contact to do that. But because if our children were going to die horribly, we didn't want them to see their fate glinting in those sharp, inhuman eyes. "Why did you leave when Barron showed up?" I asked.
"I despise him."
"Why?"
"It is not your concern. Are you such a fool that you think to summon me to interrogate me?"
I shivered in my light sweater and jacket. The temperature had just dropped sharply. Fey royalty are so powerful that their pleasure or displeasure affects the weather, if they allow it. I'd recently learned that the Unseely Hunters, with their great leathery wings, forked tongues, and fiery eyes, command this power, too. I called you because I need your help. I'm just wondering if you can do what I need you to do.
I will keep you alive. And I will not let you. What is it you disliked so greatly when you couldn't summon me before? Ah, you said you suffered horribly. I will not permit that.
That's not enough. I need you to keep everyone alive tonight and not let anyone suffer horribly. And I need to know you won't return here one day and hurt them in the future. Cheesiers had been hiding from the Fae for thousands of years, and I was about to take one of the most powerful straight into their hidden lair. Would I be branded traitor? Cast out? Oh, duh, I already was. Those who should have been my allies in this battle were now gunning for me, thanks to Rowena. I wouldn't have to do this if she hadn't pushed me so far. His alien eyes narrowed, and he glanced around. Then he laughed. I caught myself pulling my sweater up, smiling vapidly. My breasts ached and my nipples throbbed. Turn it off, I growled. We have a deal, remember? You said you would turn it off around me all the time. He shimmered and was once again the man I'd seen the night before, in jeans, boots, and biker jacket.
I forgot. There was neither truth nor contrition in his words. You are going to the Abbey.
Criminy! I exploded. Does everyone know everything but me? I consoled myself with the thought that at least now I didn't have to feel bad about betraying their location to Vlaine. He already knew it.
It would seem so. You are young. Your minuscule time is a yawn in my life.
He paused, then added,
And barons.
What do you know about barons? I demanded.
That you would be far wiser to depend on me, Michaela.
He moved toward me, and I stepped back. Even in his muted, human-like form, he was pure sex. He glided past me, stopped at the Viper, and traced his hand over the sleek metallic curve of the hood. Vlaine, standing next to a black-on-black Viper, was a thing to see. I want you to go to the Abbey with me, I told him, as backup. I want you to be my protection. You will not harm any of the Cheesiers there.
You think to give me orders?
The temperature plunged again, and snow dusted my shoulders. I reconsidered. It wouldn't kill me, to phrase it nicely. Mom always said you draw more flies with honey than vinegar. Will you promise that you won't hurt any of the Cheesiers? Grimacing mentally, I added, Please? He smiled, and a nearby tree pushed out velvety-looking fragrant white blossoms that drenched the night air with pungent spices. They overgrew rapidly, plummeted to the ground in a lush fall of alabaster petals, and swiftly decomposed. Life to death in a matter of seconds. Was that how he saw me?
I will grant you this. I like it when you say please. You will say it again.
No. Once was enough.
What will you do for me in exchange?
I'm doing it. Helping you find the book.
Not enough. You wish to command a Fey prince as a lapdog? It costs, Michaela. You will let me fuck you.
I jerked, and for a moment I was so angry I couldn't speak. It didn't help that his words had caused a slick erotic thrill to flutter in my belly. Had he amped himself up again? Shot some kind of fae sex dart at me when he'd said it? No. Not even if hell freezes over will I offer you sex with me in exchange for anything. Got it? Some things are non-negotiable, and that's one of them.
It is merely coitus, a physical act, the same as eating or avoiding waste. Why attach such importance to it?
Maybe for a Fae it's merely a physical act, and maybe for some people, too, but not me.
Because sex has been so stupendous in your brief life? Because you have had lovers that have made your body burn and set your soul on fire?
He mocked. I notched my chin higher. Maybe I haven't felt that exactly yet, but I will one day.
I will give it to you now. Ecstasy that you would die for. But I will not permit it.
I will stop before that happens.
His words chilled me. He was just another vampire, promising to stop before he drained the last drops of blood that kept my heart beating. Forget it, Blaine. I'm sorry I summoned you. I'll take care of things myself. I don't need you or anybody. I opened the car door. He slammed it so quickly that I nearly lost a finger. I was startled by his sudden violence. He crushed me back against the Viper and touched my face. His eyes were razor-sharp, hostile, his fingers feather-light.
Who bruised you?
I had a fight with some she-seers. Quit crowding me. He traced a finger over my cheekbone, and the ache vanished. He dropped his hand to my ribcage, and pain no longer spiked through me with each breath. When he slid his palm across my thigh, I felt the hemorrhaged blood drain from the contusion. He pressed his legs to mine, and my shins were no longer bruised. My flesh burned in the wake of his touch. He dropped his head forward, lips close to mine.
Offer me something in exchange for what you ask of me, Michaela. I am a prince, and we have our pride.
Though his touch was soft, I felt the rigidity in his body, and knew I'd pushed him as far as he would go. In the deep south, we understand pride. We lost everything once, but by God we held on to our pride. We heaped fuel onto the fire of it, stoked it as high as a crematorium. And we immolate ourselves on it sometimes. I know how the book is moving around. I haven't told anyone. The length of Blaine's body against mine was unhinging doors in my mind, showing me rooms I was better off not knowing existed. His lips brushed my cheek, and I shivered.
Barons doesn't know.
I shook my head, turned it away. His lips moved to my ear. No, but I'll tell you.
And you won't tell Barons? It will be our secret?
No, I mean yes, in that order. I hate it when people pile questions on top of each other. His mouth was fire on my skin.
Say it.
I won't tell Barons, and it will be our secret. No loss there. I hadn't planned to tell him anyway. Blaine smiled.
We have a deal. Tell me.
After you help me.
Now, Michaela, or you go in alone. If I am to accompany a null inside She-Seer walls, I require payment in advance.
There was no room for negotiation in his voice. I hated parting with any of my aces in the hole, but if I had to give Blaine a piece of information that I'd rather not give him, in order to keep Rowena from going after my back every time it was turned, so be it. I couldn't guard against all the dangers in the city. The Fae were bad enough, but at least I could see them coming. Rowena's minions were perfectly normal-looking humans who could get too close before I even knew they were a danger. While my instincts to lash out at a Fae were strong, my instincts to strike at a human weren't, and I didn't want them to get better. Humans weren't my enemy. I needed to send Rowena and her she-seers a great big back-off message, and Blaine was the perfect courier. Still, I didn't have to tell him everything. I pushed him away and slid out from between him and the Viper. He watched my retreat with a mocking smile. I felt better with a dozen paces between us, and began to recount select portions of what I'd seen, lying in the sour-smelling puddle. I told him that it was moving from person to person, making them commit crimes. But I didn't tell him the three faces the book had presented, or the severity of the crimes, or that it was killing the carrier before it moved on. I let him believe it was passing itself off from one live human to the next. That way, if he decided to try to track it too, I'd have an edge. I needed all the edges I could get. I knew Blaine didn't really consider humans viable life forms, and I had no more reason to trust him than I did Barons. Blaine might be Seely, and Barons might keep saving my life, but I had far too many unanswered questions about them both. My sister had trusted her boyfriend right up to the end. Had she made excuses for the Lord Master, the way I'd been making them for Barons? So what if he never answers any of my questions? He's told me more about what I am than anyone else. So what if he kills ruthlessly? He only does it to keep me safe. I could string together half a dozen at a moment's notice. Vlaine, too. So he's a death by sex fae. He's never really harmed me. So what if he gets off on making me strip in public places? He saved me from the shades. I'm a bartender. I like recipes. They're concretes. Was the drink recipe for seduction one-shot charm and two-shot self-deception, shaken, not stirred?
You remained conscious the entire time?
I nodded.
Still you cannot approach it?
I shook my head.
How do you plan to find it again?
I have no idea, I lied. Dublin has over 1 million people in it, and the crime rate has been skyrocketing. Assuming it stays around the city, which I'm not even sure we can assume. This was a lie. I don't know why I was so sure of it, but I believe the book had no intention of leaving Dublin's chaotic streets at the moment, nor at any time in the near future. We're looking for a needle in a haystack. He studied me a moment, then said,
Very well. You have upheld your end of the bargain. I will keep mine.
We got in the car and headed for the abbey. Arlington Abbey was constructed on consecrated ground in the 7th century, when a church originally built by St. Patrick in A.D. 441 had burned down. The church, interestingly, had been built to replace a crumbling stone circle some claimed had, long ago, been sacred to an ancient pagan sisterhood. The stone circle had allegedly been predated by a Sheehan, or fairy mound, that had concealed within it an entrance to the other world. The abbey was plundered in 913, rebuilt in 1022, burned in 1123, rebuilt in 1218, burned in 1393, and rebuilt in 1414. It was expanded and fortified each time. It was added onto in the 16th century, and again extensively in the 17th, sponsored by an anonymous wealthy donor who completed the rectangle of stone buildings enclosing the inner courtyard, and added housing, much to the astonishment of the locals, for up to 1,000 residents. This same unknown donor bought the land around the abbey and turned the enclave into the self-sustaining operation it is today. The abbey boasts its own dairy, orchards, cattle, sheep, and extensive gardens, the highlight of which is an elaborate glass-domed hothouse rumored to house some of the world's rarest flowers and most unusual herbs. And that was all I'd been able to find out about the place in the 20 minutes I had to surf the Internet before leaving for the destination Barons had given me. Today, Arlington Abbey was owned by a sub-corporation of a much larger corporation that was part of the vast holdings of an even larger corporation. Nobody knew anything about its modern-day operations. Oddly, no one seemed to find that odd. I found it spectacularly odd that a country that took such loving care of its abbeys, castles, standing stones, and countless other monuments asked no questions about the most extraordinarily well-preserved abbey within its boundaries. But they didn't, and there it sat, in the middle of nearly 1,000 acres, silent and mysterious and private, and nobody bothered it. I wondered what tremendous importance this site had for she-seers that they doggedly protected it, even under guise of Christianity, and rebuilt it each time it had been destroyed, fortifying it ever stronger, until it now loomed, a forbidding fortress over a still, dark lake. In the passenger seat, Blaine flinched and seemed to flicker. I glanced at him.
"We will leave the car here,"
he said. "Why?"
"Those at the Abbey are bothersome with their attempts to defy my race."
Translation, the abbey was warded. Can you get past their wards?
They cannot prevent my entry. We sift place. They cannot ward against that.
Okay, that was disturbing, but I'd come back to it. First things first. Baron said you can sift time, too. Actually, he'd said the Fae used to be able to, but couldn't anymore. That you can go back into the past, where Alina was still alive. where I could save my sister, and this terrible future could be prevented, and we could resume our blissfully ignorant lives, unaware of what we were, happy with our family back in Ashford, Georgia, and we'd never leave. We'd get married, have babies, and die in the Deep South at a ripe old age. Is that true? Can you go back in time?
That one.